Holland to America. Became landlords where none had been before. Soon one man owned 500,000 acres on both sides of the Hudson River shore. He invited families to move in and give him 30% of everything they grew every year. This is how they'd pay the rent. His name was Rensselaer. He became one of the richest men on earth. In today's terms, $90 billion is how much he'd be worth. All this for doing nothing but saying all of this was his. I have the power of the state behind me, and I'm in the landlord biz. After 200 years of this, and one revolution won, another Rensselaer had another son. And this Rensselaer was greedier than his ancestors dead and past. It was the 1840s, and things were changing fast. It was the straw that broke the back. The bottle was uncorked. They started organizing meetings, the tenant farmers of New York. They found the strength of numbers. They found the power of suggestion. They found each other asking the same question. Who gave you the right to be a landlord, to live a life of ease while others toil?
Indeed, who gave them the right to be landlords, to live a life of ease while others toil? We'll be talking about our own Rensselaers here in Portland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm your host, Paul Rowland. You just heard Dave Rovics with his song Landlord from If I Had a Hammer. We're going to be talking about gentrification, engine of disaster capitalism, to follow up on last month's discussion on rent speculation and the selling off of Portland with my two guests, Sarah Rudolph with Portland Assembly. Good morning.
Morning.
And Megan Hansen with a data activist.
Good morning.
Good morning. And yes, we'll be talking about the Central East Side Industrial Council's Enhanced Services District, which passed by a vote last month. And we'll be talking about, let me just read the introduction that I wrote on our page for a Wednesday Talk Radio on KBOO.FM. Portland area residents are currently faced with a slew of development and gentrification-related policies, but the relationships and dynamics behind these policies are often difficult to see, from government incentives for redevelopment to international companies speculating in Portland rents to business expansion districts trying to masquerade as public improvement. Is difficult to navigate all the connections. As I said, continuing last month's show, which is linked on the program page, which you can look up at kbo.fm, on the Central East Side Enhanced Service District and Wall Street-driven rent speculation, we hope to help you connect some of the dots. We get rent increase caps that might actually help big property management agencies instead of renters, and residential infill projects, which clear the way for even more expensive apartments without guaranteeing any relief for cost-burdened residents. The commonality is that these policies transfer money from the poor and middle class directly to the pockets of the uber-wealthy. Another commonality is displacement, as more and more people are forced from their neighborhoods and from their homes. The increasingly apparent man-made crisis of hypercapitalism offers no answers. Houseless people are further targeted as business owners and developers seek to clean up areas that are slated for gentrification. Actually, I could let you, Sarah, read this since you wrote it. Anyway, we'll hear right now from Sarah about her take on the City Council vote on the Central East Side Industrial Council's proposed Enhanced Services District, and later hear from Meg about the intersection of incentives, Wall Street interests, Mayor Wheeler's interests, and the various players who are profiting off of Little Portland's big boom and bust. Take it away, Sarah.
Oh, all right. Well, I think this is interesting because this is kind of where the rubber meets the road on these policies. We see all of these incentives And, you know, y'all talked a lot about rent speculation last time. And this is the effect of rent speculation, is that we see, you know, business owners and developers, primarily developers in a particular area, the Central East Side Industrial District, deciding that they want to be able to access more of those incentives. And so enhanced services districts are an answer to that for the owner class. As you saw, we saw in New Orleans a couple years ago, they started instituting private security patrols, but only in rich neighborhoods because it's funded by homeowners groups and things like that. And they have seen a pretty serious upstep in arrests of houseless folks, in police harassment of houseless folks. And that was one of the primary things that the Compassionate Change District was trying to fight, that we saw encapsulated within the CEIC proposal. One of the big problems is increased security. And even though it's you know, presented as private security, unarmed, that still doesn't stop them from displacing people, which is, of course, the primary goal of increased policing around houseless issues, is merely to push them out of a district that you don't want to see people living on the street in. So we definitely were pushing for a variety of programs that would sort of offer an alternative to that carceral approach. And I think that the package that was put together by the Compassionate Change District Coalition is pretty great, and I don't think there's anything to stop us from trying to implement it in other areas, because I think it contains a lot of actual answers to houseless issues. The things that people tend to object to are garbage, which they couch as crime. And one of the primary aspects of any of these programs is trash collection, making sure that people who live on the streets actually have access to trash collection. I mean, someone comes to my house and picks it up every week, and so I don't have a problem with that. The other aspect was that we were trying to push for peer-managed solutions. So not hiring security guards, but actually training folks who live on the streets to work with each other, identify issues, and fix them together. Now, one of the things that we saw through this process was that the folks involved in the Central East Side Industrial Council sat down with us just enough to adapt our language to their purposes. So we definitely ended up getting a package that, while it might have some language that is more humane, it definitely still has the same carceral brunt behind it. So that's certainly a disappointment. And as I said, we'd love to continue pushing the programs in other neighborhoods because they're sorely needed. But it's very hard to see the win that Joanne Hardesty talked about right before the city council vote,
which passed 5-0
unanimously, and just found out yesterday. Apparently, this was an emergency vote, which means that one no vote could have stopped it. So it kind of leaves us wondering where we stand with city council. But we know where developers stand with city council. And that has been a constant, is that the developers' interests are the ones served here. And that's something you can definitely, I mean, the entire force behind the CEIC were development agencies. Beam Development was one of the big motivators, but there were, I think it's 34 development agencies in the Central East Side Industrial Council, and
which, of course, as I should let people know if they don't know, that's an area that stretches from I-84 to the Ross Island Bridge and the Willamette River to 12th Avenue, and KBOO sits squarely within that area. And actually, the KBOO board did pass a resolution in favor of the Compassionate Change District. Well, go on with what you're saying.
Oh no.
This enhanced services district couldn't just be about, you know, more security and the problem of garbage. I mean, was there anything in the enhanced services district that actually talks about the proposed increased development of the area?
Well, they couch it in terms that are a little more shadowed, so they talk about innovation, and there's a lot of money in their budget for innovation. And just real quick, their budget comes from a tax levied on business and building owners in the neighborhood, but it also comes from parking revenue, which is public money, which means that technically we should get a say in what's done with it. But that's probably one of the big problems with business districts, is it takes any of that choice out of the hands of local residents and puts it directly into owners.
From what you know about it, or even what you've speculated about it, what do you see the grand plan for that area being?
Well, that area, it's very interesting because, and Meg will probably talk about this a little more in a few minutes, but there's sort of an overlay of zoning changes coming through that neighborhood. And that's one of the things that we really need to be aware of, is that anytime the city or the state proposes a zoning change or any sort of housing-related policy, we need to be watching very closely, because this is all directed by developers at this point. And most of them are out-of-state developers. Beam is a small player compared to what we're actually up against. Mm-hmm. So really, looking at that district, you've got the Opportunity Zone, which is the big Trump program that has been administered in several different cities. Ours has chosen, the state chose to actually designate the entirety of downtown Portland and most of the Central East Side as an opportunity zone, which would indicate that it's a blighted zone and needs development incentives. So that's going to make, you know, give you less time to wait for your permits to come through for demos. It gives you incentives for building, gives you tax breaks. And the Opportunity Zone is not the only zone that is affecting that area. There are other things that we look at, like RIP, which is something that's being proposed. Even the URM, the unreinforced masonry conversation, really affects this neighborhood as well. Mm-hmm. So all of this is just layered policy in favor of developers at this point.
And let me just remind you, this is Wednesday Talk Radio. You're just hearing Sarah Rudolph with Portland Assembly talking specifically about the Central East Side of Portland, but we're going to be talking more broadly about these dynamics, how they're playing out in Portland, and sort of the national and international scope of it. I wanted just the show's called Gentrification Engine of Disaster Capitalism. I'm sure people know what that term is, but I just found a kind of very concise definition I'll just read here. An extreme form of capitalism created in the immediate aftermath of a disaster. In some cases, as in Chile, the disaster is a coup d'etat with the express purpose of imposing disaster capitalism. In other cases, such as the 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami, it is a genuine natural disaster that literally kills. After some disasters, the authorities in some countries may well respond by imposing, quote, reforms that would have been impossible before. These include, one, privatization of public property, making it unavailable to the indigenous people or local people, two, arbitrary elimination of laws, deregulation, and three, slashing democratically chosen programs that help ordinary citizens, austerity programs. The concept was popularized in Naomi Klein's excellent 2007 book, The Shock Doctrine, and it goes on a little bit, but I think that's a pretty concise definition.
I do think also that part of the shock doctrine, whether we're talking about really sort of apparent examples of disaster or whether we're just talking about this sort of constant state of shock, part of the fabric of that is that it is a construct that is intended to essentially make people more compliant with those changes. They sort of shut down and regress. There are sort of different iterations of disaster capitalism, and we are now existing in this sort of perpetual state of emergency. Here in Portland, we have a declared housing state of emergency. We now have a nationally declared construct, a so-called national emergency at the border, which is really just to circumvent the democratic process and to move money around.
So talk a little more about this, because people, you know, what people think of, what I thought of, and I'm sure I'm like most people, I hadn't given it nearly enough thought. In fact, the synapses are just starting to click a little bit here. But so, you know, you think of this idea of declaring a housing emergency, you think of, oh, we're going to mobilize public resources to actually help the people who are suffering from economic and other distress, and, you know, specifically living out on the streets, which we see so rampantly here in Portland. Mm-hmm. So there's another dimension. We were talking before the show, you talked about actually this, the vote as an emergency vote, it was because it was related to this housing emergency.
So there's always sort of two sides to these sorts of policies. One is the intent by which everybody gets on board and says, yes, we need to treat this as an emergency. Yes, expedite, do something now. And so there are regulatory engines that kick in upon declaring states of emergency for that purpose, that intentionally remove certain, not barriers, but certain toll gates from the bureaucratic process, those toll gates that are meant to, that tend to slow progress down because there are more protracted periods of public engagement, more checks and balances. But upon a declaration of emergency, the intent is that we have to do something about this now. And so sometimes that does allow good things to happen immediately. There are certain provisions where you can act quickly. And then there are ways in which that then becomes a premise for saying that it is for the benefit of those who are most impacted, those for which that emergency is declared to create, you know, to at very least provide some triage, and then that gets that can get hijacked. So there's two sides to that, and when we see that shift, and it takes a while to sort of unpack these different iterations, not just in declarations of states of emergency, but in sort of all things having to deal with vulture capitalism, is that you have this co-opting of the narrative and this appropriation of the pain in order to clothe neoliberal agendas in the phrasing of urgency and in the phrasing of progressive politics. I think Sarah was hitting on that with the Compassionate Change District, where they were listening and they were saying, oh, well, there's how to talk about that thing, but we don't actually necessarily want to implement that thing, but it sounds a lot more palatable. Thank you so much for that lesson in how to now put on the clothing of that compassion to do the opposite.
It's funny you say clothing, because the big glaring example of this was actually, we had been talking about wanting to create low barrier situations for folks on the street to get involved in maintaining their own programs, basically. So if we can establish a safe sleep location, we want to hire folks who live on the street and utilize those programs to administer those programs. And we had talked about it in the way of it being a low barrier job opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And they took low barrier, which we, you know, when, you know, we run warming shelters, Portland Assembly,
yeah.
and we use low barrier to mean that we probably will not turn you away if you
yeah.
have a pet, if you are, you know, inebriated, we're probably still going to let you come in and not freeze to death. When the finalized proposal came back from the Central East Side Industrial Council, they had taken that language and applied it to something else entirely. And so they said that their security guards would be wearing low barrier uniforms. I don't really know what that means. I can only assume that they intend to mean that they will be undercover and look less intimidating, which, of course, is just another way to slide policing in.
I mean, they've got like a rainbow patch on the shoulder.
Yeah, I don't.
But
I
it does. It does bear out the fact that they almost got it, but the intent on their end wasn't to actually understand it.
It
was just to sell it.
It's like when a local car company tries to use a meme in their advertising, you know?
And fails.
Yeah.
You know, there's another great example of this. In 2015, of course, was the year that Portland declared this housing state of emergency. And I believe it was October. On the heels of a lot of renter and tenant sort of storming the castle and declaration of a renter SOS declared this housing state of emergency. And at the same time, there was sort of this united front that was saying, you know, we're getting double-digit rent increases, and there's not only a displacement and eviction epidemic, but also a demolition epidemic. And we want change. And Governor Hale, or Mayor Hales at that time, surprisingly enough, put forth, and I don't know if it was him that put it forth, but there was an effort at City Council to enact a demolition tax. And the Home Builders Association was successful in shutting that down. And they were so successful in using a new tactic that they bragged about it. And they submitted their tactic to a National Home Builders Association award. And part of the submission for that they won, as a matter of fact, for government affairs, they bragged about this new tactic wherein they said, you know, Portland loves its progressive politics, progressive this, progressive that, in a very sort of mocking tone. And then they went on to elaborate how much sort of against the righteous indignation of their membership, they developed a new tactic. And wherein they seized the progressive agenda, attacked from the left, and engineered testimony, and bragged about this, won this award. And it was so successful that now we are seeing that blossom. and I think also part of the part of what Naomi Campbell talks about in terms of
Klein,
disaster.
Yeah.
Not Naomi Campbell. How could I? Well, anyway, Naomi Klein talks about in disaster capitalism is that the sort of the architects, she talks a lot about the architects of disaster capitalism. And I think that one of the things that us citizens we're struggling just to make ends meet and to deal with this sort of constant barrage of shocks to our system is that we are sort of stuck in this place of playing checkers. We play checkers while global capitalists and while lawmakers are playing three-dimensional chess. And we are sort of forced into these states of this sort of having to be myopic. And then when we do, you know, all of this stuff, I think we all already know a lot of this. It already resonates, and yet it can be somewhat overwhelming. And that's part of the shock doctrine, is that when we confront it, we say, this is just, it's, you know, I still have to get up and take a shower and put my pants on and go to work. I need to go into a willful state of denial right now so that I can get the laundry done and so that I can pay the bills. And so part of having conversations like this is to dive in and to say, like, we need to look at this and we need to look at it from the 50,000 foot level. And then we also need to dive in and look at the mechanisms and the systems. And then we can take a breath and then we can try to do better at spotting this.
I know what you mean. I actually tried to have a conversation with my dad last week about the purse situation. Yeah, and
let's talk about that.
Let's talk about purse. So I got to the point that I actually felt bad.
That's P-E-R-S, not P-U-R-S-E.
No, this is public employee retirement funds, which are all caught up in this.
And how?
Yeah, in this disaster capitalism, housing securities issue. And I was starting to kind of delve into this with him, and I actually started to feel badly because I know that it is a huge and kind of terrifying issue.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it is definitely difficult to, like, have conversations about these, like, these things because they are so big.
Okay, before we dive into PERS, again, this is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm the host, Paul Rowland, every week, and I have with me Sarah Rudolph and Megan Hansen, and we're talking about gentrification engine of disaster capitalism and related topics. And this is a call-in show, and the number to call in and join the conversation is 503-231-8187. Yeah, just before we go into that, I just want to, you know, this obviously the fact that there's so many people sleeping in the Central East Side, a lot of people concentrate there. There's a number of places where they are in Portland who are unable to afford a living in a place, which is the real problem, which, you know, we seem to, people bend over backwards to not directly avoid. They try to use all these sophisticated sleights of hand to continue to make money for the people who have a lot of money and not actually put that many people in houses. But anyway, so obviously those people are an impediment to whatever plans, whatever big plans are for that Central East Side, because, you know, they just don't look good. And the, you know, the fact that I just want to, you know, the fact that, you know, they, those people have real human needs, that they need to have places to go to the bathroom. They need to have their, they need to not have their stuff taken by the police. They need to have, you know, their garbage taken care of, et cetera, et cetera. They probably, some of them need social services. They certainly need, first of all, a place to live. Anyway, that's the real focus. And so now we're going to talk about, as we talk about PERS, we're going to talk about, you know, the this affordable house, you know, the housing crisis has many facets. One is, you know, people living on the streets. The other is just that people can't, the main thing is people can't afford. And so there's all these big, huge schemes now at various levels to supposedly address the question of affordable housing. Anyway, I just want to...
Maybe this would also, before we talk about PERS, to talk about that big scheme for opportunity zones in particular. And this is a federal program that picked census tracts where the residents in those tracts, 20% or greater, lived at or below the poverty line, under the premise that this would be drive investment to lift all boats. And yet there's no requirements to do that. And part of what the opportunity federal, part of the Trump tax plan, is a massive...
That's where these opportunity zones were. That's where it was created. They were created.
Yes. Yeah. And the governors of each state got to choose from, you know, an assortment of these districts and then to designate. And so pretty much all of the core, the urban core of Portland has been designated. And what that allows is massive tax break. Capital gains taxes. Capital gains are the ways... that's how... the wealthiest people stay wealthy and accumulate more wealth is capital gains. Capital gains when they sell their stocks and they're worth a bundle, when they're the CEO of a major corporation and they get bought out and they get their golden parachutes and all that good stuff. So this tax plan basically allows what they call large equity events. So if you just have windfall profits and you don't want to pay taxes on them, you can put them, invest in a myriad of different ways into these opportunity zones, and you can not only, and there's sort of a tiered step, so depending on how long you hold it, you can not only reduce your tax burden, but you can avoid being taxed on that wealth altogether. And it's going to cost our government billions of dollars in what would otherwise go into social programs to allow those tax breaks. And so the plan for this Central East Side and downtown is to incentivize those types of developers who need and want to shelter like we're talking about, where can I build a high rise so that I can put my $200 million there and not have to pay taxes on it? So we're talking about, and already there are billionaires who have already gone on shopping sprees in here in those districts.
Well, and we also should remember that because rent speculation is what it is, and the market is actually in those properties and has no relation to whether they're occupied or not.
Maybe you should just clarify again, because we did talk about it last month, but maybe some people weren't listening. What is this rent speculation? How did it develop?
Well, I mean, pardon me. Meg might actually be able to get into it a little more, but basically, we know how the stock market works, right? That we're not actually like trading, say, grain on the stock market. We're trading the value of that grain as perceived in the future, right? So when the market becomes real estate, when it becomes land, that land value is completely untethered to the actual property itself at this point.
And we can talk too about how, you know, in 1999.
So there's rent. Mm-hmm. There's basically a rent derivatives market now.
Yes, absolutely. Well, and this is how it happened. So in 1999, with the repeal of Glass-Steagall, the banking industry basically went from being somewhat boring, to being literally a casino. So speculative, private equity, speculative lending. There used to be sort of a veil, a firewall between speculative lending and commercial lending. And that veil was removed in 1999. And that's when we had our first bubble. And basically what that allows to those who securitize, at that point it was, single-family home rent or single-family home mortgage-backed securities. And then they start betting on those. And then they start making side bets. And then there's side bets on those side bets. And then you have all of this conjuring of fictitious wealth. So if you imagine a casino and bets and side bets, that's the nature of this now. And you have, and in hindsight, when we look back at after the crash in 2008, we look back and said, oh, well, yeah, that's what happens when you basically have the banking and financing industry able to play both sides, hedging their bets, and the house always wins. And then after the crash, we had is Blackstone, the world's largest private equity corporation and now Wall Street's biggest landlord, cleaned up and swept up and while everybody else was suffering, gathered up all of those foreclosed homes and turned them into rentals, sometimes renting them back to the people who had just been foreclosed upon. And then when they had amassed enough of those, they bundled those up into these bespoke tranche deals. And then they created another unregulated product called rent-back mortgage securities. And so they are trading. I mean, we talk a lot about, housing is a human right and how housing shouldn't be commodified. And I think some people think that that's still sort of a concept of commodified housing. It is a bona fide commodity. It is not only being traded in private bonds, but also on publicly traded as well. And so that's where when we talk about about this whole new mechanism to create these bubbles of speculation. It's not about creating houses for people to actually occupy. It's about creating mechanisms for investment and for conjuring that wealth. And when you endeavor to create these bubbles and conjure all that fictitious wealth, it is predicated on it being on it collapsing. And those who have, those who are engineering that are also ready and waiting. They sell at the top of the market to the greater fool, and those greater fools are left holding the bag. And then they swoop in after the collapse to grab everything up at a discount and so on.
So you mentioned Blackstone. Maybe that does lead us back into the PERS.
Oh, it does.
Oh, it does.
Oh, it do.
Yeah.
But so I think everybody, you know, if you're not already familiar with Blackstone, you should be. And we can talk about Blackstone here even. A lot of times when we talk about these big, massive sort of corporate institutions, I think we in Portland, we still, you know, these people have been here for a while, still have this sort of hometown feeling that that all that stuff happens in the big cities, but it's already here. It snuck in. And when Ted Wheeler, before he was the mayor, he was the state treasurer. And as state treasurer on the Oregon Investment Council, that's where there's a five-member council where they basically handle all of the investments for public employee funds and into the PERS, the public employee retirement system. And there was something interesting that happened in that Wheeler made a decision to invest at that time over $1 billion in private equity. The majority of that went to Blackstone.
He thought it was such a solid investment, apparently.
Well, the timing of this, too, is you've got the full benefit of hindsight and looking back at the crash and saying, what just happened here? For whatever reason, that has even bloomed now. So there's even more. We're going to talk about Blackstone because it's sort of because they're sort of at the top of the heap. But Blackstone also has been here in Portland with their Washington State billionaire partner, Holland Partner Group, Clyde Holland, who also contributes to Mayor Wheeler's campaign, by the way. They've been here already. Just in the last 2 years, Blackstone and Holland together bought and sold over $2.5 billion of multifamily real estate. If you look at, I pulled a report over the last 3 years and a quarter, and the amount of a large corporate investors purchased over $5.8 billion in the Portland area of multifamily units, with about 26,500 units. And that's happening here.
So would you say those are mostly already existing historical buildings, or are they also the ones that they're buying up and demolishing
Both.
And building new ones?
Both. There's, okay. Yeah, and just for the listeners too, there's a document that I think you'll post a link to on this program site that has all sorts of links, not only to reports like that that show all the units who's buying and selling. So there's a mixture of buying up all of these existing units that are currently, in market parlance, underperforming, meaning that they're home to low-income families and they're below market. And so the first thing that happens when they purchase those up is they get rent increases. And then there's also, you can also see where there's multifamily housing that was built in 2016, built in 2017. And so that's also, you know, there's been other reports too about how real estate has always been this perfect place because it's also a cash business. If you've got cash, it's a perfect place to launder money. And in this bubble, that's how they conjure that wealth, is by flipping and flipping, and not just flipping single family houses like we, you know, sort of are accustomed to when we look at the first bubble, but they're flipping, you know, large new builds to the greater fool.
So So there's a couple things we need to investigate further. Obviously the PERS, but so you're saying that these, you know, these, what I call them, these big box, you know, block, usually like a whole block, they take up a whole block, there's
the
three or four stories. Yeah. So you're saying that these are being actually bought and sold in a short period of time also?
Well, that's also, I mean, let's understand too that the first person, the person that makes the money, so you got the developer who demolishes and then builds and gets the financing for that. And while we're whenever we're talking about financing, also keep in mind that all of that debt is securitized. So we're not really talking about sort of the value of housing. We're talking about the value of the debt and the value of the interest, the compounded interest, and people placing bets on both sides in terms of the health of the debt market. So you have a developer that comes in and breaks new ground. And the developer isn't the one that's going to manage the rentals. They just build it, and then they sell it to the greater fool. But that person probably is still, you know, at the on the incline. And then they sort of manage getting it leased up to X percent, where then they flip it to the next investor who is more interested in you know, a building that has, you know, 50, 60% occupancy. And then they have some corporate property management company manage it. And so all of...
So is that like, are we talking like a maximum that a lot of these new construction are they're looking at actually having occupied is 50 or 60%?
Well, that's the first, that's like the second turn.
Okay.
You know, and then they say, and then the greater fool comes along and says, wow, everybody's winning at the table. And that's when you also have predatory lending schemes coming in too. So there are all sorts of new private equity lending schemes that say, if you're going to be investing in multifamily housing, then here, everybody's winning at the table. It's a hot, hot, hot market.
And so most of those private equity, they're obviously mostly not local. These are national and international operators mostly.
I mean, the ones that are lending in this market, yeah, they've also private equity. When we say private equity, we're talking about unregulated banks. And everything that goes along with that. And I should also note that some of the protections that came along after the first housing crash, a bill called Dodd-Frank, that took a look back and said, wow, there was sure was a lot of fraud going on with these mortgages. Let's put some safeguards in so that the banks, commercial lenders basically have to have assets on hand to cover their bets. Not only did the Trump administration try to sort of roll some of that back, but much of those protections don't apply to multifamily housing.
Well, you know, let's take a pause here. I think you've stunned our listeners into
silence.
I'm
sorry.
Because no one's called in yet, which is actually fairly rare. We usually have quite a few callers.
This is the shock doctrine.
But 503-231-8187, I guess laugh or break down into hysterics. I mean, at this point.
I do both daily.
I think one of the things that's interesting and that people don't recognize is that sometimes even before a building, like even before the units in a building are up for lease or rental, that property has actually changed hands two or three times with an increase in profit each time. Okay. So like this is wild speculation, what's going on in this market. And
the new Wild West.
Well, I mean, it's the old Wild West too, because it's definitely, I mean, we rolled up here 150 years ago and decided we owned stuff. So like, and we've been pushing this scam ever since. So if you think about like, properties, I don't know, watching Merrill Hurst close and thinking about how recently that actually would have been in tribal hands and how easily it could go back to those hands like has been kind of interesting.
I think it's also too, just to kind of connect the dots too, as we talk about all of this conjured wealth, there tends to be when we're talking about houselessness and when we're talking about the economic violence of displacement and gentrification, there tends to be this political narrative that says, that wants to place those things into two separate silos and to say, well, the economy is booming. wow, people sure are suffering over there. These things are unrelated. Don't look over there, look over there. And yet, I mean, common sense, we all know that a speculative real estate gold rush on one hand and massive displacement, suffering, and gentrification on the other are two sides of the same coin. And in fact, one is predicated and necessitates the other. And yet, we have lawmakers who are either willfully ignorant or know the difference and prefer not to look and address the root of it. And part of the root is just being able to say, well, let's get the data. And that way we can stop arguing with, you know, trying to say, well, is that the false narrative or is that the false narrative? And yet, for instance, Mayor Wheeler has the trifecta of departments under his purview that have to do with housing: the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, Bureau of Development Services, and the Portland Housing Bureau. And they could collect data that says, what's really going on in our local real estate market? I want to look at all the sales data to see who, what entities are buying up this property, how much flipping is going on. And that way, then maybe we can take a look at some and connect connect the economic suffering over here to the rents, to the rent speculation and to the land grabs, and then to put in some mechanisms that instead of siphoning all that wealth over to Wall Street, put it back into our communities. And yet there has been no effort. It's been left up to people like me and other people in our spare time to try and cobble together fragmented data wherever we can get to prove that this is actually happening when we all know that it's happening. If Forbes is writing about it, if yeah. Mainstream media is saying, well, this is a problem, guys.
But before we go to Robert and then Mary in the last 10 minutes here, but, you know, A, capitalism really isn't the problem. But, well, B,
you can't
actually talk about it. And C, well, it's too big to fight anyway. Anyway,
capitalism is definitely the problem.
Well, I was making
okay. I just
I was just saying that's still the default.
We just
narrative.
We just need to build more. More market rates so we can trickle down in 30 years. I hope you guys are fine waiting until then.
Right. We do have a couple callers finally. So Robert, go ahead. You're on the air.
Well, my first comment is facetious. I believe in joining the committee to make slavery nicer as opposed to ending it. Capitalism is terrible. Your comment earlier about Ted Wheeler and the State Investment Council, do you remember Meeker and KKR and PERS? Do you know that story?
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned KKR. It's interesting that you mentioned KKR because I've been digging into
who's KKR?
KKR is also another large
Holberg, Kravitz, and Roberts.
Large player, and Oregon is one of the major, or Oregon PERS is one of the, sort of the major holders of KKR.
It was the
products.
First.
Yeah, yeah.
So when Meeker was state treasurer, he was approached by the thieves from KKR saying, "Hey, we'll give you 18% return on your public investment money, and it's pretty secure." And he went, "Great, I want everything I can get into the PERS system." So he was the first state to enfranchise the KKR people with state money. When he got his returns at 18%, all the others lined up and said, "How much do you want?" And basically what they did was they purchased private companies with public money, busted their pension funds, and basically public pension funds were used to destroy private pension funds. And it was, and then when Meeker retired from the state of Oregon, KKR gave him $40,000 worth of stock or something, and the Oregon Supreme Court said it wasn't a kickback; it was legal.
I would certainly love to see what Ted Wheeler has in his stock portfolio. And interesting that you should mention KKR, because part of the research that I just did turned up a recent court settlement where Blackstone, KKR, and TGP is also in the Oregon PERS. I'm just going to read this here. Three of the world's largest buyout firms have agreed to pay $325 million to settle a U.S. lawsuit accusing them of colluding with rivals to keep prices down on corporate takeover, prior to financial crisis by agreeing not to outbid each other. And this was a case brought by Kentucky pensioners accused these groups and others of misrepresenting black box bundles of hedge funds as safe investments when they were expensive and contributed to the state pension system's virtual insolvency. So I'm glad that you mentioned KKR. I may not have brought it up otherwise.
Well, when I mentioned this to my friend, who's an honorable, moral person and a state employee, he handles underground tanks for the Department of Environmental Quality. It's a good job. He's protecting us. I said, KKR is you know, busting private funds in order to assure the viability of your retirement system. And he said, I don't care. I want the money in my retirement. I don't care. So the thing is that as we compete with each other, capitalism wins. And, you know, separation and isolation seem to be the lifeblood of the competitive system. Anyway, that's my comment.
Thank you.
Well, and at this point, with the amount of our purse funds that are in these speculative industries, I don't know that they can actually save anybody's purse funds, like, by savaging someone else's retirement at this point.
I mean, let's get real. So, right now in Oregon purse funds, 21% is in private equity. That's $16.2 billion. And currently 10.7% of that is in real estate funds, $8.3 billion.
So they're basically entered the casino and are gambling on the total makeover of Portland.
Yeah.
it is a for-profit. I mean, and that's the thing. They want profits to, and yet, which horses are they betting on? They're betting on the same horses that are going to break the world.
Well, and considering, I don't know, that money could be going to, like, shore up industry in Oregon or something like that, like provide actual generative, like, fields for people to work in here.
Yeah,
like,
to say that we can't invest and also have a conscience.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought the whole idea, you know, of the progressive Portland was, you know, to disinvest from the fossil fuel industry and other nefarious places and to do good work with it to transform the economy. Anyway, so let's
the word investment is to surround. A vest that a person wears and buttons up the front surrounds you. Investment does not mean participating in. It means controlling by surrounding.
Well, I didn't realize you were still with us, but thank you for that final comment. I was just going to say, let's go to our next caller. Thank you. Thank you so much for calling. That was a good call. But Mary has been waiting. So go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, you guys. Thanks for this, finally. Can you talk a little bit about the neighborhood associations? Now, I felt in mine, it's Richmond Neighborhood Association. I felt for a long time it had been infiltrated by the very thing that you were talking about earlier, where people hear what we want, hear what we're saying, then weaponize it against us. So I think people now that have been moving to Portland join neighborhood associations, they're opportunists. So they see an opportunity to beef up their resume, meet and greet other powerful people that have inns in various places, and that's what they're doing. So I've noticed this for a very long time, been an activist for a long time, and it's something that we have to be really careful about, I think, and it's been going on for years. So could you talk a little bit about the neighborhood associations, the people that profess to care about the neighborhood, but they're really just beefing up their own personal resume. Okay, that's
okay. We gotta move on. Thanks.
I think I definitely see that in some of them. I mean, one of the things about Portland's neighborhood association system is that there really are a lot of different types of groups that come out of it. So we see a lot of neighborhood associations that are really, really aggressive towards houseless people and are not interested in working with programs and are much more interested in developing close relationships with the police, who, as we've seen, arrest houseless people at an inordinate rate. I think it's 52% of arrests were houseless people in 2017. So that's definitely something that we pay attention to, is which neighborhoods are looking for that policing reform, mm-hmm. or the policing answer. Now, one of the things that you mentioned is people coming in trying to beef up their resumes. I actually have seen that a lot in city council invited testimony. Every time I go to a city council meeting to talk about something or investigate something, there are several people who are clearly lobbyists giving testimony at the top of the session, and they are the invited testimony by Wheeler or council members, and their agendas are glaringly obvious, and they are always very well received. And that is something that I definitely like, especially if that is something that's leaking out into neighborhood associations, which I can imagine that those developers, because that's who they are. It's developers. It's people trying to like soften up neighborhoods for further encroachment. So, if that is getting to that point, then we should be paying attention to that for sure.
I would also say, too, that I have witnessed a coordinated effort from the YIMBYs, which we don't have time to talk about, to sort of astroturf via the land use committees in certain neighborhood associations, and they get invited as invited testimony, and they have this it's engineered testimony.
And then there's even groups that go around to other neighborhood associations and try to enlist them as being more aggressive against houseless people.
The cult of the invisible hand.
Yeah.
Listen, I unfortunately can't stress enough that people need to call earlier in the program. We have two callers waiting. I don't think I can get to either of you because we really literally have less than a minute left in the program. So Chris and Joe, thank you for calling. I'm sorry we can't squeeze you in. But next week is another show.
Go to the Portland Assembly Facebook page and we'll talk there.
Portland Assembly. I was going to ask you all, so ways to get plugged in, because obviously you're not just wanting people to absorb the information. You want people to do something with the information.
We do. There's a lot of information about this on the Portland Assembly webpage, or Facebook page, sorry. Also, we're probably going to open the Sunnyside Warming Shelter tonight and tomorrow night, so you can go there for information about volunteering. We would love some folks to come help. But also, Meg has been doing a lot of research lately, and we make sure to push out anything that she publishes on our page.
So you
can find a pretty like solid wealth of information there.
And I think you'll put a link on this program page to some stuff I put that's following the money. It's loaded up with links, so if you want to, if you're ready for your head to explode, dig in.
Okay, and there are always people who would love a phone number or a real mail address or something. I'm not sure you can provide that now, but maybe in the future, think of that. Yeah, everybody's online now. Sorry, because there are not just a few listeners, I'm sure, who are in that boat. But anyway, coming up next on The Radio Activist, we'll feature suicide prevention programs in the Portland metro area, and the Oregon Arts Council is holding conversations about race. Thank both of you. We've got to get out of here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Paul.
All right.
Patroons came from Holland to America, became landlords where none had been before. Soon one man owned 500,000 acres on both sides of the Hudson River shore. He invited families to move in and give him 30% of everything they grew every year. This is how they'd pay the rent. His name was Rensselaer.